The following talk was given by Jed Larson at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on September 5, 2021. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning. Good morning. Nice to see everybody. I was recently listening to a podcast, and there is an interesting little insight that came up that I thought would be interesting to talk about a little bit here today. In the podcast, the host was bringing up an economist. You may know the name John Maynard Keynes. He's the economist from, I think, earlier part of last century, so early 1900s. And apparently Keynes made a prediction based on what he knew about the current economy and different types of, I should take my mask off. Yeah. Is that better? A little more clear? Sure. He made a prediction about what he felt was going to happen to the U.S. economy based on what he was seeing from changes in productivity and advancements in certain types of technologies. And what he came up with basically is he felt that not too long from that point, early 1900s, the U.S. would be so efficient that people would only be working 15-hour weeks. We'd get to a point where we could maintain the standard of living that we were having at that point and just be so much more efficient. We'd work so much less. It was an interesting insight in the sense that, I mean, we obviously know now more than or about 100 years later that not much the case. We're working as much, if not more. I think it was a striking prediction there to see kind of an indicative clue as to how we end up kind of recalibrating ourselves to having a little bit more. So you kind of think of the hedonistic treadmill there. So this economic system that we've set up is not so much for ending wants, but it's created to create more wants, really, and to create a sense of scarcity or need. And I thought that that prediction, that little clip there, made me think, what does Buddhism have to say about this? This tendency of kind of wanting a little bit more, and continuing that down that road of, what is it exactly? Our proclivities towards continuing to want a little bit more, never really being satisfied. And that brought me to a teaching of Katagiri Roshi. I think most of you know Katagiri Roshi. He is a 20th century modern Zen master here, started Zen in Minnesota, Japanese born. And I'll be referring to a chapter from Returning to Silence. The chapter is Thirsting Desire. And I thought that that kind of addressed kind of what we've started out here with the intro and that insight of Keynes and what that reveals. This chapter, Thirsting Desire, addresses the Four Noble Truths, but in particular, the First Noble Truth. And you'll hear that translated in a lot of different ways. Sometimes suffering, we'll hear about craving related to the First Noble Truth. The craving brings about desire or suffering. And the title of that chapter here is Thirsting Desire, so you can sense that all those terms are talking about the first noble truth. And Kadagiri actually starts out the chapter with a little bit of a story from the Buddha during his last days. Some monks were coming up to him and knowing that he was near the end, and they're wondering, what do we follow once you're gone? What's our sort of guidepost for moving forward? And the Buddha said, when you see me, see the Dharma. So I think what he was trying to indicate there is that we should be focusing not on a specific teacher or what we think is some source of information, but to rely on the Dharma truth and to really take this practice up ourselves. That's really what we need to do in the end. We can't rely on anybody in particular to do this for us. And also, I think it's an indicator that this is very much about practice itself. It's not a specific teacher. The Buddha was saying it's not him. I think he's also saying that it's not the teachings as we would normally think of it either. But really, this is everything about the teachings is trying to encourage us to actually practice, to take up the activity of awareness in our life. And Kadagiri says that the first noble truth is suffering. He says that we can't escape this. And again, I'll be using some different terms interrelatedly. He normally uses the term suffering, but again, you can think of dukkha as a helpful term. As we get into a couple more details here, I'll explain a little bit more about that. But I think he's talking about unsettledness. Is a word that came up to mind too, particularly in terms of this Keynes example, that people at the time of Keynes were, they had their standard of living, but something throughout each generation or throughout each year and decade, something is kind of missing there. You know, it's like we are continually looking for something else. Therefore, we're just working a little bit more to get it. We think that getting things will solve it. So this first noble truth, I think, is speaking to that as well, that there's, it's just like an honesty, basically, that we can recognize this impulse of human activity where we're seeking something. Kadagiri says we're apt to attach to pleasure, obviously. So why exactly then does Buddhism say look at suffering? It seems, why exactly are we looking at this unsettledness? And as I say, it's just to simply have an honest look at human life, to these tendencies and proclivities that tend to come up perennially, continually for us. So it's not a pessimistic thing, I would think, in looking at suffering. This chapter is addressing thirsting desire, but rather just a healthy approach, and to understand, or to actually just be realistic about what our life is, and not to be too gloomy or anything, but this teaching of the first noble truth is opening us to understanding. It's interesting to also note that particular if you look at the term dukkha, it's trying to indicate that this first noble truth is not just something very narrow in terms of what we normally think of what suffering is, but it actually captures what we think of as pleasure as well. categories is indicating that we kind of have to go beyond our idea of suffering versus pleasure to understand what the first noble truth is, this thirsting desire. And I think even if you take a look at what desire is and a close look at it, basically, you could see that there's certain expectations and anticipations that go along with even something like pleasure. So again, just to kind of loosen our ideas about what suffering is or pleasure is, certainly I think of examples in my own life where something is, you know, going along in which I think is very ideal, but if that changes, the dissatisfaction is instantaneous. So it's like a clue that there's probably some attachment going on, even during what I thought was like a pleasurable experience or something that's ideal. And not to scold oneself about this, but just to notice that there's certain beliefs and attachments that can come up for us in pretty much any type of experience, whether we think it's good or bad. So the term dukkha is, again, opening up kind of a clear picture of what human experience is. Maybe a little less of a dualistic way of seeing things. It's just very strictly good or bad, but kind of brushing away that judgmental or evaluative way of looking at things and seeing something that's more quiet there, and to see a craving or, you know, just simple grasping or aversion that can be happening. Yeah, not to judge ourselves, but just to see something that maybe we hadn't seen before. So as I say, category says, dukkha or suffering is a holy truth. I'd say the truth of what human experience is. Thich Nhat Hanh makes this same pretty pointed statement in The Heart of Buddha's Teaching to say that actually suffering is a holy truth, because it's almost a little shocking to our ears, I think, to hear that. You know, how could suffering be a holy truth or a noble truth? But Thich Nhat Hanh says, you have to embrace your suffering, hold it closely, and look deeply into it. The way out of your suffering depends on how you look into it. That is why suffering is called a holy truth. The truth of the path is one with the truth of suffering. And with a lot of Thich Nhat Hanh's teachings, when I read it, it's almost like suffering takes on a little bit of a different inflection there. Like he has this kind of caring way of talking about suffering, as in not something to judge ourselves or push away, but something that we can actually take care of, whether it's our suffering or the suffering of others. And the real central aspect of this quote here, I think, is he's getting to understanding. He says, it depends on how we look into it. And that's why it's a holy truth, is it's what we're really talking about here, is understanding what our situation is. I just finished up the novel Crime and Punishment recently. I don't know, maybe some of you have read it. Maybe it's been a while. I don't know. Some people read it in high school or college, but one aspect of it that I didn't notice until the end, basically, is it brought to mind a lot of different novels that I've read or stories or movies that I've seen where the author or the writer is can tend to set up different characters that are appealing or not appealing, or have kind of an orientation of making the characters like have the notion that you have to, the reader has to be kind of invested in a character one way or another. And often it ends up being like you're kind of for somebody or against somebody, but even not even, you know, so much that you'd be kind of like I say, invested basically in the characters. But one thing I noticed about Dostoevsky is, like in the case of one character, it's you're pretty quick into the story. You're not quite sure whether you, you know, like if the person is committing a crime, you know, whether you think they should go to jail. Sometimes in a story, you know, it's a criminal, you kind of want them to elude the authorities or whatever, just to create some excitement there or whatever. But then also it's kind of like you don't really want them to go to jail. You're not really landing on, I don't know exactly how he does it, but what is dominant in the storytelling is that you really get a sense of what their experience is. So you, I think the author in this case is, he knows that he doesn't need to rely on making you kind of like, feel connected or repelled by somebody. So sort of avoiding that judgment way of setting up a story, but actually just giving you a clear picture into how this person is doing what they're doing, what they feel. So it's much more of a orientation of understanding. There's another character in the story that is marrying a person who is much lower class, and this person kind of thinks of them as sort of helping the person who's lower class out. And when things don't go well in the relationship, that person has no idea why. You know, it seems like they're kind of the hero, but then you hear the other person's perspective and it's pretty clear that this person is trying to take advantage of the person of lower class in a lot of different ways, sort of lord things over them and so forth. But it's kind of like the event happens where there's this break off of a relationship and you don't know exactly why, but then you go into the stories of either these people and then you can see clearly why the person of upper class just has no idea why that just happened basically. So all this is to say that, like in the case of a story, we can think of it in terms of judgment, like good people versus bad people. But with a great novel, I think it's speaking of understanding. So the same thing here with suffering. It's not so much judging suffering or thinking that that's something that needs to be gotten rid of, or that it's bad, but to know what it is, know how it arises. Really comes down to knowing what is true to life instead of getting caught up in ideas and chasing after ideas, but actually clearly seeing what is true. So that's what the holy truth is, the noble truth is about, that we don't actually need to ignore our life. And even in the cases of maybe something nice is happening, we'll be able to fully appreciate that moment by moment. Katagiri talks about three types of suffering. And if any of you have taken the Four Noble Truths class here at Dharma Field, you'll recognize that we have three triangles, or two triangles. Actually, I just describe it as one triangle split into three sections, indicating three types of suffering. That would be physical suffering and mental suffering. And then a very subtle aspect of suffering, dukkha. And I won't go into detail too much there, but if you haven't, it's covered in Buddhism Plain and Simple too, but the class for sure, if you haven't taken that class, and it's available on MP3 on our website, gives a very clear teaching for that. So I'll just leave that three types of suffering there, because Katagiri gets right into the most subtle form of suffering. He calls it radical suffering. And it's, let's see here. I'll just read a quote from him. He says, radical suffering is the suffering produced by the transiency of phenomena. Realization of this suffering is something you can experience through deep practice. Excuse me. Through deep practice, or through deep understanding of the total picture of human life as it interrelates with all sentient beings. And the description there is, it's hard to know exactly what he's talking about there. And it's understandable too, because the First Noble Truth is speaking of dukkha, this very subtle suffering. And kind of when you think about it, if you think, it's understandable that it's hard to know what is being talked about here, because I was thinking about, even if I hesitate to use an analogy, but if you think about an illness that absolutely, like an example of an illness that everybody has, like how would anybody ever know that it even exists? You know, if you just think like of a medical ailment, which goes to the genius of what the Buddha understood there, to actually notice something. Like how would you know that this illness exists if you have nothing to compare it to, basically. So I thought I'd bring that up, in the sense that Katagiri is talking about something here of exceeding subtlety. And we'll get back into that just a little bit. I have another quote also from Thich Nhat Hanh, just as a bit of a reminder as we talk about dukkha, or this thirsting desire. Thich Nhat Hanh reminds us that when we hear these teachings, I think he's giving us a helpful reminder that it's not, we need to go beyond thinking of this as just simply as a teaching. Thich Nhat Hanh says, impermanence, or you could say, they use the term impermanence there because Katagiri talks about the transiency of phenomena. But you can put anything here, impermanence or thirsting desire or dukkha. I would say, he says, impermanence is more than an idea. It is a practice. He says that it was offered by the Buddha as instruments of practice. And he's talking about the anatta, teaching of anatta, not self. So he's talking about all these things as practice and helping us see that there's maybe a bit of a pitfall of kind of getting into a philosophical way of seeing these teachings. But both Katagiri and Thich Nhat Hanh are constantly pointing back to practice in terms of understanding truly. Because I don't think you could ever get to the subtlety of what dukkha is just by kind of reading about it or thinking about it. We have to understand the importance of practice and recognize what the teachings are. And I think in many ways, the teachings are simply an encouragement for us. So if something sounds right in the teachings to us, or we feel a genuine feeling for it, I think maybe just the way, at least how I began this practice, is that was an encouragement for me to read more about it. You know, I was like, that sounds right. But I think the teachers are saying, if this resonates in a sincere way, then we should practice. We should really do the practice. And that means mindfulness in everyday activity, but also what we think of as formal meditation too, that these teachings are really, you know, they encourage us to find other teachings too, but really, I think there's a heartfelt feeling by these teachers that they want the teachings to point towards encouragement, towards practice itself. So Katagiri is talking about experience of radical suffering, and one might ask themselves, you know, why should we be trying to experience suffering? But Katagiri says, when you practice, you understand human feelings. And he also says, this suffering is very calm. And again, this is speaking more to what we would think of as dukkha, the subtle suffering. He says, this suffering is very calm, very still, and very silent, but it is still there. And so why are we going to try to experience suffering? But it's not so much that we're going towards or trying to create suffering, but just recognizing that ache of the heart to know what peace actually is, to recognize that that's probably something that's always with us, that we really want to find what peace truly is. It's easy to kind of think of it as something pessimistic too, particularly if you're using the term suffering and so forth. But ultimately, what we're speaking of here is freedom and understanding. Katagiri says, what is Zazen? Zazen has nothing to say. Zazen lets you touch the core of your suffering. This is okay. Thoughts and ideas are going on and on. So this nothing to say is the quiet meditation hall, the Zazen practice, Zazen sitting meditation. We have a space, you know, maybe here at the meditation hall or at home, a space in Zazen is not bringing any fabrication or preconception at all. It's just an extremely simple and straightforward practice. It's not loaded with anything. So all the different requirements and expectations and, you know, whatever we may dabble in our everyday life, we can just leave all that at the door. And how many opportunities do we have in life where we can just set that down and have a quiet space? So it is quite an opportunity to just dedicate ourselves to a settled activity and devote ourselves completely to it. So I think that's kind of what Zazen is, what Katagiri is trying to get at. Katagiri also says, and this is a pretty interesting statement here. He says, thirsting desire, and again, just to clarify, the term thirsting desire in terms of first noble truth is sometimes described obviously here as suffering, and often it's described that the suffering arises from craving. But what Katagiri here is saying, I think, is kind of the craving and the suffering are basically the same thing. He says, thirsting desire drains you and keeps you from seeing thirsting desire. It's almost like I kind of need to come back to that and read it a few times because it almost sounds like circular reasoning or something. I'm not sure, but thirsting desire drains you and keeps you from seeing thirsting desire. Or you could think that sounds pretty, kind of doom and gloom or something. I mean, how do you get out of that? But the one aspect I was thinking of when I read this is, if thirsting desire is keeping you from seeing thirsting desire, it's just an indication that our life shows up in completeness. So if there's distraction happening, it's completely distraction. And if we notice distraction, then we're back already. So it's completely noticing, or it's completely, we're right back in this moment. So the idea of some sort of cause and effect is not really too helpful, probably. So again, it maybe sounds pessimistic here, but it actually is saying that in this moment we can return. So this instantaneous understanding can be what this moment is for us in coming back. So either we're caught in thinking or we're back in this caught in thinking. I thought I'd bring up a little bit about belief too, because that's such an important teaching. And when we sit down in meditation, obviously we can see a lot of thinking going on. I mean, that can certainly happen. It's not unusual at all. It's kind of continuing on. It can be distraction after distraction. So it's simply just caught, we're caught up in thinking. And what's happening there is belief is operating. And in reflecting on what belief is, maybe we'll belief basically is the culprit of what prevents us from awakening, basically. And maybe what we would think is, how do we find belief, or how do we like kind of identify it and then try to get rid of it? I think maybe is the normal way of thinking about how to solve problems. I suppose you could say that thinking is somewhat easy to identify. You sit down and meditate, but it's almost like belief is pretty, maybe there's some beliefs that we can kind of see happening. But I think certainly there are some that are just like the belief in kind of a fragmented world of this and that. There's some beliefs that are, you can't really maybe identify them. And I just say that in the sense that it probably doesn't help to try to identify or to even focus on labeling thinking or like making distinct observations of any type, particularly in meditation. But then also we might think, well, I don't really believe in this or that. We might try to kind of convince ourselves that belief, we're not really operating out of belief. But if there's any way of kind of knowing that belief is operating, I think when we sit in meditation and we see thinking happening, essentially we wouldn't be continually thinking about things if we didn't have an investment or feel that there's like a truth to what we were thinking. So I think maybe just that's the simple indicator that belief is going on there. And again, not to judge ourselves, but to know that to really understand what belief is quite helpful, because I keep saying it's not about judgment, but it's actually to see directly what we are thinking is true. And all Buddhism is saying that is that, and again, it's always pointing back to practice. It's kind of like saying, if we want to know what's true, then pay attention to this moment right now, the sound of the chipmunk chipping. It's right here in this experience. That's what we should be focused on. Not about rooting anything out. And knowing what belief is, I think, is helpful in recognizing that there is an unassailable truth in experience itself that we can truly recognize instead of putting all our effort into thinking and desiring and so forth. Category says that you don't know when or how it will come up. It's almost kind of like we can't choose what we believe or don't believe too, which is also a encouragement to practice too, but to keep the practice very simple, because there's no use in even trying to predict when distraction will come up or trying to make ourselves not believe or anything in that regard. Only simple and direct following the breath is really what's recommended. Anything else is just adding extra complexity when it's not really needed. Just simply do what we're doing in this moment, in its essential sense, without any assessments or narration. It's something we can do in everyday life, even during heated conversations or whatever it might be, just to come back and kind of just settle ourselves again, come back to this moment, and then we can probably see more clearly how you know, if it's a conversation or whatever we might be distracted with, coming back to this moment can help us see what is right in front of us. Category says, so Buddhism doesn't try to ignore or destroy it, suffering. Buddhism knows very well what thirsting is. Thirsting there, so we don't try to destroy thirsting. He concludes the chapter. I'll just read that real quick. He says if you study the four holy truths, you can realize that the extinction of thirsting desire or human suffering is not to cut off or destroy human suffering. You cannot do this. Therefore, Buddha has to say that human suffering is a holy truth beyond what you like or dislike. So practically, what should you do? Just focus on the actual human life and put the four holy truths into practice. And in the chapter, he comes back to that emphasis about focusing on human life and to give our full attention to whatever it is that's going on in our life. That's everything that we have right there. It's this human life. Put the Four Noble Truths into practice. So know what they are. But that wisdom can be manifest in the action of being present. Again, whether it's our daily life or our formal sitting, to the point where it can be the same. Steve Hagen has a chapter, The Color of Meditation, and Meditation Now or Never, and speaks about how our entire life can take on this color of meditation. So not necessarily just formal meditation or even where we would sort of even drop the delineation of any different aspect of our life, that the entirety of our life can take on this color of meditation. I asked Mary for some quotes from her class. I enjoyed that so much. It was the third class that had a few things that I thought were related to this. I won't actually have time probably to get to the ones that you sent me, but there's another aspect that I thought was very, just the way you talked about it. You were reading something from Now or Never and Meditation Now or Never, and you felt that this was very important. If just to kind of paraphrase what you were talking about distraction being vital to meditation. And I thought that was just a really kind of powerful reminder. We'll talk about suffering here and maybe the judgments that we have about distraction or suffering. But what Mary brought up in her class in many different ways is whatever is happening, distraction is the ground in which our meditation practice is happening. Anything other than that really is just to kind of fabricate some otherness, basically, that we want something else, you know. But Buddhism is saying, come back to the truth of this immediate experience, and we can actually take care of distraction as it's happening, not to have any opinion about making it go away. And just noticing that distraction, kind of as I was talking about before, noticing it, we're already back. So we might think distraction is bad and we're not really noticing anything. We're just kind of get stuck in a judgment about that we should not be distracted or something, but really that's not needed at all. Coming back or noticing, we're back already. There's this presence. There's no transition at all. There's no cause and effect. And I think Mary was kind of talking about that immediacy of practice and not trying to get rid of anything at all. There's one other part that I wanted to touch on real quick. It's something we, just in conclusion here, something we talk about in meditation instruction. I thought it was applicable for this chapter in regards to meditation, but then also, you know, kind of what do we do about this? You know, we'll kind of hear the term thirsting desire, but what, you know, what does one do? Obviously, there's the recommendation to actually practice, take up practice, which I've talked about. But in meditation instruction, there's maybe a little bit of an insight there too. We talk about two kind of parts of, for lack of a better word, of mindfulness meditation, and there are tranquility and awareness. And Steve Hagen's book, Meditation Now or Never, talks a bit about it, I think, in a couple spots for sure. I think it's maybe second to last chapter. So you have these two aspects, seemingly two, tranquility or settledness, but then also concentration or awareness. And a lot of the time, those don't really seem to work, or we don't think of them as being compatible in everyday life. You know, think about concentration. Maybe we'll think about studying for a test, or kind of just like our brain is starting to smoke at some point if we concentrate too much, or, you know, so we got this certain idea about it. But in terms of what we're talking about in meditation instruction, the other side of that, and actually it's not the other side, it's having these completely together, having a settledness. And it's a settledness that's not necessarily requires that we're like completely placid or not active. I think of the example of being out in nature, where maybe that's an illustration of the ability to really be calm. You're settled, but then also you can really be attentive. You know, maybe there's a, you walk to the edge of a valley, and then it's like fully, you're fully experiencing what it is. And, but you're also settled too. You don't have, there's, the agitation is not there. Katagiri says also, about this, these two terms, and it relates to Shikan. He says, this is called Shikan wholeheartedness. It is single point, pointedness of mind. With such a mind, you respond perfectly to whatever situation you are in. To sit precisely is to hit Zazen. To hit the head of Zazen is Shikan. Shikan actually means nothing but, or wholeheartedness. It is one-pointedness of mind. To sit this way is to manifest your life in simplicity beyond your speculations of good and bad, right or wrong. So he is kind of a different, he says, so you have Shikan as tranquility awareness. Katagiri says that you can understand this as nothing but, which sounds different than tranquility awareness. But if we get to the core of what I think this is trying to say to us, is that it's just simply about being present. So nothing but is just being present. Tranquility awareness, just being present. So I thought I'd bring that up. He talks about Zazen there, so Shikan, but Katagiri also talks about Shikan, basketball, I think, and other types of activities where it can be nothing but whatever activity we're engaged in. I think that's pretty much all I have. So I'd be open to questions if anybody has anything.
microphone so people can hear?
Okay. In regard to the first part, the very first part of your talk, John Maynard Keynes, we could all definitely live simpler lives, but much of what we work for is actual improvements that have come along since then. Like cars now have airbags and backup cameras and a lot of other safety devices that cost money. And now we need to get all electric cars, you know, to save our environment, and that's going to cost money. Health, just all the advances in health, all that costs money.
Yeah, I think so. And there's probably, I'm not an expert on it too much, but I think there's probably room for that too. He was predicting 15-hour work week, which, even if you dedicated another 20% to advancements that are things other than like what would be all the frivolous things that we have now and all the stuff that we entertain ourselves with, I think we could probably admit that there's a lot of things that are not needed. But as I was saying there, the 15-hour estimation there would probably leave a little bit of room for making technological advancements. So it's, it's all kinds of things. It's competition, which includes, you get into the realm of military aspects in, the competition between nations and how much money is being wasted there and all kinds of different things. It's all stemming out of desire and the dangerous advancements that we have made fall under thirsting desire as well. So I would think, when you think about how much we spend on many things, including the military, we would have a lot to invest in renewable resources and so forth. We'd probably be doing fine and be working 20 hours a week, but and I'm not an expert on it, but it's always up to us to figure out what is a just thing to pursue or what's, I can certainly think of a lot of things that I have that I probably don't need. And then we lose a lot too, living very distant from the land, hard work and things like that. We lose a lot by getting the kind of nice efficiencies that we think are great, but we're actually getting disconnected from the planet in a lot of different ways by all the advancements that are happening too. So, but yeah, it gets down to understanding desire and really knowing. So it's just an example of this kind of spinning that we do continue to, or the example is that desire is never appeased by more desire, basically, and that's what we're doing. So to expect this some sort of solution from that is the main thrust of the example, that it is not a solution. It may be something that we can pursue in different ways, but we just need to clarify for ourselves what is going to actually solve these problems, and it's not desire. So that's a good point, though. There's a lot of great things that have come about. So if people on Zoom didn't hear that, Steve was talking about just to recognize is to resolve the conundrum that we're in, basically, just to see it. If I'm kind of quoting you quickly here, to And then also there's a chapter in Buddhism or Meditation Now or Never that I think kind of addresses what you're talking about, that we just don't see, we don't understand the seeking that we're doing. We don't see that that is what we normally do, and that is the problem. Basically, we're seeking after happiness, and we're basically blocking happiness. The chapter there, I think you have a couple quotes from Bai Jiang. So if anybody on Zoom wants to kind of follow up on what Steve, maybe you couldn't hear what he was saying.
I remember the page number.
Yeah, was it?
It's page 165.
Page
165. In which there are quotes about seeking.
Yeah.
Very active seeking in suffering or something like that in Meditation Now.
Yeah. So it's around page 161 in Meditation Now or Never, or 165. So just to refer you there. Yeah, thank you, Steve, for your comments there, and Mary too. Thanks, Mary, for the page numbers in your class and everything, David too. So we're at 11 o'clock. So thanks to everybody. It's great to see you. Have a good holiday weekend.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.